And I'm very pleased to introduce Marit Fleur-Jørgensen, who is Program Director at the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Network. And we're very happy that she accepted to give a presentation here today. But before I introduce Marit, I thought that I would say a couple of words about Women in International Security Malta. I think several of you have not attended any of our previous meetings. So we're part of a larger international network of organizations whose aim it is to promote women active in international security and international relations more generally. WISE has a number of branches in Europe. Most active are in Brussels, in Belgium, in various parts of Germany, and in Estonia, for example. WISE also has a wider international network which operates from the United States, with a newly set up branch also in Russia and one in India, for example. This is also reflected within the WISE Malta branch, which consists of both Maltese women and foreign women like myself. The goal of WISE Malta is similar to that of the other parts of the network, which is to promote women in international relations and in public life in general. And we do this through a number of activities. Firstly, public lectures such as this one. We also hope to launch a WISE Prize for an outstanding student at the University of Malta. We also participate in public debate in Malta, and we hope to launch some research activities as well. Our geographic focus is, of course, Malta, but it goes beyond Malta to the Mediterranean and the wider Middle East. And that's why we're particularly pleased to have Marit with us today. She will address the issue of women's rights in the wider Mediterranean. And as you probably know, the deficiencies when it comes to women's rights in the Arab world has been pinpointed as one of the main issues preventing also economic development and social development in the Mediterranean. So that means that this issue is not only important in its own right, but also for society and the economy more generally in the Arab world. But I will not dwell upon this, because it's Marit who is the expert, and she's going to talk about this in depth. So Marit, she has studied Arabic and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Copenhagen, and she wrote her thesis on political development in Yemen, and in that context she spent 2 years in Sana'a for her research. She then went on to work in Hebron as part of a multinational observer force there. Since 1998, she's with the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Network, and in 2006, she became program director at the network with the responsibility for program management and coordination. So I'll now pass on to you, Marit.
Thank you. Well, I first of all want to thank VIIS for inviting me. I mean, it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to discuss some of the issues that I find very important, and I really hope that we are luckily in some ways a small audience, that we can do it very interactively, because first of all, I feel bored hearing myself talk all the time, but I would also like the opportunity. It's really a chance for me, I think, to hear some of your views on issues related to gender equality. I think for me, the focus of the lecture in many ways would be, I mean, why should we at all work on gender equality or on women's rights? I mean, why is it that gender equality is important, and how do we do it? And I think that's where my focus will be, and I hope that you will ask a lot of questions and come with your opinions on that issue as well. And specifically, I find it interesting because Malta is really strategically placed really in the middle of the Mediterranean, and I think also Maltese culture in many ways is a mix of so many different, I mean, your history is full of so many influences, both from the Arab world and from Europe. So I think you are very in a very good position, in a way, to discuss this issue with me. And then I want to, I'm so pleased to see this audience, that there are so many men. Because often when I talk, or even in the network, when we work on the issue of women's rights or gender equality, we tend to be only women dealing with the issue. And I think it's a pity, because as Anna already mentioned, it's actually been proven over and over that, I mean, dealing with women's rights, it's not something that you need to do because of a moral or ethical obligation or whatever. It's actually, it makes sense from an economic point of view. If you look at the Arab Human Development Report back from 2002, one of the reasons for the, let's say, the lower performance of the Arab world in relation to human development, they mentioned three main reasons, and one of them was the lack of women's participation in society. Meaning that they actually argue that because women do participate so little in society, in decision making, that the societies are simply not economically very well developed. And I think that's an important point to bear in mind, that women's rights is not only for women or only because we feel a moral obligation to work at it, but it's actually also, it really makes sense from an economic point of view, from a development point of view. I would like us to do it this way, that I talk and you interrupt me and you ask questions meanwhile. Then we can take a round of discussions afterwards as well, but that you, if there's something that you find interesting or less interesting, that we kind of try to move on in the direction that you find mostly interesting. What I thought of doing was to give you a very brief overview of the situation of women's rights in the region. And I would then go on to talk a little about the positive changes that I think have been taking place since 2002, and to talk a little about how they came about and how perhaps, you know, this will give us some ideas about how can we actually continue to work on this issue. So I will try to kind of draw some lessons learned from both my experience of working on the issue and also from living in the region. I just first of all want to make one reservation, and that is that when we talk about the Middle East, the wider Middle East, the Middle East and North Africa, sometimes also called the MENA region, it is somehow a constructed common. It's like putting a lot of countries that are very different into one box. And we say, well, this is the Middle East. And it gives us a notion that there is a lot of commonality. It's like one unit. And I really want to make it very clear that the situation in the countries are very different. I mean, the situation, let's say, in Lebanon and Yemen, even when we talk in relation to women, are very different. So I want to make this limitation I want us to recall that there are very big differences between the region. So what I'm doing is, obviously, I'm going to make some very broad generalizations. And I think that there might be things that I'm saying that doesn't hold true exactly for one specific country in the region. But I still think that there are some issues that are common to most countries in the region, and that it makes sense somehow to outline these issues, because I think you can talk about some commonalities. Then we can talk, there might be different strategies how to address the issues. But I think it's important both to bear in mind that there are very big differences, but also that there, I think you can see some commonalities when we talk about the Middle East. Then I want to, when I started, I will say that Anna mentioned I work for something called the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Network. It's an NGO. Having 84 members. Members are human rights, women's rights organizations in the Arab world and in Europe. And when the network was created back in 1997, we wanted to work in relation to kind of EU-Arab frameworks, because we thought that the Barcelona process at that time, the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership, might be that some of you know about it, was kind of a context that gave us an opportunity to promote human rights and women's rights. One of the first thing we did was kind of to map the ground. So we did a report that looks like this, that calls the integration of women's rights from Middle East and North Africa into the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership. And it's basically talking about looking at what can we call the main problems in relation to discrimination against women in the region, what are the main actors that work in relation to promotion, protection of women's rights. And the third chapter, which I will not talk about now, is we analyze the efforts of the partnership. What did they actually do in relation to promoting women's rights in the region? And very generally, we can say that the discrimination in relation to women is embedded in laws. I think that's often the case. Actually, it's not specific to the region, but what is specific to the region perhaps is that the laws that concern families or family law, that means any laws in relation to marriage, divorce, custody, inheritance, often called the personal status law. Most of these laws in the region, despite them being civil laws, are derived from an interpretation of Sharia, the Muslim law. And what is common for most of the personal status law in the region is the idea of female guardianship. What does it mean? It means that women need to have a legal guardian. It means that women will not be able to contract their own marriage. They will not be able to contract the marriage of their daughters or of any other woman. It means that it's kind of a man is the only one that can have the legal responsibility. He's the head of the household, simply. And I mean, that has, of course, as you can probably imagine, big implications in because it in somehow governs a woman's life. And we can see it materialized, for example, in relation to marriage. There's often different age when a boy or a man and a woman can marry. It's often much lower for women than for men, for example. There's also the thing that a Muslim woman can't marry a non-Muslim man, but a Muslim man can marry a non-Muslim woman. In relation to divorce, for example, a man can just say, "I repudiate you," three times. I mean, it's a special saying he can say, and then it's considered a divorce. While a woman would have to seek the authorization of a judge, and there would be only in very, very limited cases, very specific cases, that she would be able to obtain a divorce. Otherwise, she might ask for, or she can financially compensate the man. It's called like buying. I mean, a women's organization would say it's buying your freedom. It's called hol in Arabic, that kind of agreement where you can, in a way, seek divorce by financially compensating the husband. There is the issue, of course, on polygamy, as probably most of you know, that a man will be able to marry up to four women, while a woman will not be able to marry four men. I mean, the issue is that in some law or some countries, for example, now in the new Moroccan law, it's actually been not totally abolished, but you've met so many requirements that it's basically impossible. Then in many countries, it's not very widespread simply because it's economically too expensive. Because there is very clearly stated in the Quran as well that if you do that, you have to be to treat them equally. Which means, of course, also that you should provide the same financial means to both families. So it's not very widespread, but I still think many women's rights organizations see this as an important issue because of the discrimination in it, that men can do it and women can't. But it's not, I would say, a very widespread phenomenon. What more often happens is simply that men would divorce, because it's very easy to divorce, and then they would remarry. Then there is also, in relation to the nafaqa, the right to support, that a woman, if she remarries, she will lose the right of custody of her children. The children that she had with her husband that she then has been divorced from. While this is not the case if a husband remarries, he still has the rights, and that is often has big implications for women because the procedures can be very long. There can be like pending procedures where the woman will
I mean, the husband will have left her, but he had has perhaps not remarried, and so on. So she will be left in a kind of limbo, in a very unclear situation, and she will not be supported financially. And if she then wants to remarry, she will lose the right to custody of her children.
When the husband divorces his wife, mm-hmm. and they have children, mm-hmm. Who gets the custody?
There's quite clear, in most of the laws, there are a certain age where the children will be with their mother. Often it's like, for example, until they're 7 or 9 years old. And it depends also whether it's a girl or a boy. Often the boys will stay shorter time with their moms than the girls. And then they go to their fathers. So it depends from country to country, but it's stated in the laws how many years usually they will stay with their moms before then they go to the to their fathers.
I'm a bit confused.
Yes, tell me.
And at the start, you said you're in an organization with 84 members. Member countries?
No, member organizations.
Member organizations. How many are Arab in it? First question.
About two-thirds.
Two-thirds are Arab. Now, you mentioned Sharia. It's obvious that a lot of things are dominated by Sharia law. And we know what Sharia law is. And we just had in England, day before yesterday, the Archbishop of Canterbury just blurted out that some Sharia law should be adopted among English laws, and he caused the whole rumpus. He almost had to apologize yesterday. What I'd like to know is, how can you reconcile your organization, the Sharia values, with different values, with the Western values? How can you work within the ambit of this position?
It's a very interesting question, but I think for me it's a question. It's an issue. The women's rights organization in the region, this is simply their reality. They are working within a context where you have these laws, and at the same time they work for women's rights and gender equality, which they see as are universal. And I don't think that there is necessarily a contradiction. I mean, there are many women's organizations in the region working from an Islamist perspective, for example, that looks at the Quran and says, well, you can interpret certain parts in different ways, and they will argue within some of the Sharia laws, saying, well, but this actually supports, for example, women's rights. So I think it's a matter of, I don't think that they are irreconcilable, for example, that you can say it's simply totally different values. I think often it's a matter of interpretation. So, and I think it's a negotiation as well. I mean, it's interesting to see, for example, if you look at the changes to the personal status law in Morocco. I think the reason why the changes came about were that you had a broad coalition, including Muslim clergy, that actually went into this coalition saying, well, the way that we have the personal status law now, we simply don't think that this is in conformity with the Islamic spirit, for example. So I think a lot. I mean, it's not. I think everything has to do with interpretations in many ways, how you see it and how you go about these issues. But of course, it's clear. This is where the contest is all the time. Are the values from outside? Are they from inside? Is it religion? Is it custom? And I think these things are really what is negotiated in the region over and over. It's an interesting question. Could any more on this issue, or otherwise I'll just, yeah?
What about the difference, for example, in Tunisia and Morocco, whenever you visit these countries, you see a big difference between the rural communities and those living in the city? Can you mention something about this? Because when you speak to people on the ground and you try to ask, I mean, like in Tunisia, they still have very traditional, you know, week-long weddings, etc. Even people who are well-educated, have degrees, are lawyers, they still have these traditional marriages. And when you ask, it seems that they didn't know their husbands from when they were children. So this concept, perhaps, of arranged marriages still seems to underline, at least from what I can see, many of the marriages. Can you mention something about that?
I think, first of all, it's in a very important point, and I was actually going to make that later, that there are huge differences between city and countryside in the region. I mean, it's really, really big difference. And also, I mean, I think that, for example, even in Morocco now, you have changes in laws, but it has not materialized into changes really in the way people go about doing marriages, divorce, and so on in the countryside. And there's a big gap still between adopting laws that are more gender sensitive and the implementation, simply also because the level of illiteracy, for example, is extremely high. Then in relation to marriages, it's quite interesting. I think there is a kind of, even among the urban elites, there is a kind of, I don't know if I can call it going back to tradition, but to a certain extent, I think there is a kind of, you want to go back to something that you feel is authentically your tradition, your culture. So you would find these kind of, educated and urban women that would still, the daughters would choose a very traditional marriage that would be much more traditional than their mother's had, for example. But I think that's, I mean, I don't know, I've seen that in Europe as well. I think often it's just a kind of reaction to what your mothers did. You don't want that. but I think it's a very important point that you made, the difference between countryside and cities. And I think still also the women's rights movement, one of the big challenges for them in the region is really to work with the countryside and on the local level. I think there's a tendency that they work in the cities it really, there need to be much more focus on the rural. Yes?
So apart from the legal inequalities of women, usually in everyday life, but you meet some Arab women and they're pretty happy with their situation, and they're not like, they don't feel they're losing anything or their husbands are nice to them, so they're very fulfilled. Would you say it's sort of mainstream that women would feel less than men, or is it only in certain cases and in certain countries that this would happen?
I'll answer you by a small anecdote, perhaps. When I lived in Yemen, I had two of my very, very best friends. They both lived in Sana'a, but one of them, she came from Aden, which was the kind of capital of South Yemen, which was once a separate country. And she had, the South Yemen was at a point a Marxist-Leninistic kind of country, and they had had a lot of focus on women's education and work. So she had been educated, she had been working, but she fell in love with this northern Yemeni man. And she moved to Sana'a, and she could not go out as she was used to. He didn't want her to work, and she felt very much that it was like, you know, she was in a prison. The other friend of mine, she came from a small rural village, and she had not gone to school because, well, in the beginning she went a little to school, but then there were rumors that the teacher was making advances towards the girls. So then, all of the girls were obviously taken out of school. She married this guy that moved to Sana'a, and for her, this was heaven. She could go out, she could meet women in the afternoon, she didn't have to fetch water and firewood. So I think it depends very much on both, I mean, what background you come from, which husband you get, what you are doing. So I think you can't answer the question like that. It's clear that all women do not feel oppressed. And I think the problem often occurs when you get into when you need a divorce, I mean, if you have problems, then you suddenly face the discrimination. Not necessarily if you are happily married. And I mean, I know a lot of, even in Yemen, which is a very traditional country, I know cases, for example, that a woman was divorced and the husband said, well, of course you keep the children. I mean, they are much better off with you. I will never, claim that they should be with me, and he pays custody. And so, of course, there are always these, you know, personal stories, but at the same time, I think it's important that you're aware, that we are aware of the fact that legally, for example, if you get into problems, you face this discrimination if you, for example, need to go to court. Huh?
We spoke about women's rights in Arab countries. What about the Arab women living in the West? How there, if they can they divorce them according to their Western laws, or they still have to, or they still like have the same, they have the same lifestyle as in Arab world, but they still, do they have the same women's rights as the Western women?
It's a very good question, because there has been a lot of issues exactly in relation to that. Because, for example, I know in France there's been the whole issue of which kind of, you know, laws governs women. Will it be the laws, for example, if it's a Moroccan woman living in France, will it be the Moroccan laws, or will it actually be French laws? I know in Sweden there has been the situation of an honor killing, where, for example, it's like in a lot of the countries, and I will actually, one of the things I wanted to mention is that there's discrimination in penal law as well, because often these honor killings are considered, there will be lenient sentences for the husband, because you will say, well, the woman, she's carrying like the honor of the family, so if you, the husband has in a way a duty, or somebody in the family a duty to defend if this honor has been in any way ruined. So in Sweden, for example, and in Denmark as well, there was a case, and it was clear cut that it's actually manslaughter, that we would not deal with it as an honor killing but simply as manslaughter. So there it was saying, well, even if you would, let's say, be a Moroccan or Turkish or whatever, you would still have to adhere to the Danish law or Swedish law or whatever. But there's often the issue in relation to some of the personal status issues that is not all clearer, because also if you go abroad to marry, for example, often they would have the marriage in Morocco. And I know cases in Denmark, for example, where if a marriage is dissolved in Denmark, it might not be considered as being a divorce if the person would go back to Lebanon. So there's a lot of these issues that hasn't really been clearly... I mean, there's differences from country to countries in Europe in relation to women from the region living in the countries.
What is your stand on the fact? If you are in Malta, you have to abide by Maltese law. If you're in England, you abide by English law. Go to Rome, you do like the Romans do. Now, if I go to an Arab country, I might
marry
not be
women.
Able to do Sorry. Things that they do. So... Why do they pretend that they can come across and adopt Sharia or the murders of honor that we have had quite a few in England recently too? And they expected to export their laws, but we Westerners are expected to abide by their laws, like wearing veils and other things, not drinking, etc., etc. How do you reconcile that?
I don't necessarily think it's a matter of exporting laws or discrimination or something. I think it's a matter of, I mean, often some of these, it's a matter of bringing some traditions with you. And often people, when they come and they live in, let's say, exile somewhere, they become even more traditional than they would be in the countries, if they lived in those countries. And I think that then often... Also, they live in kind of ghettos. They would live with other people. So, I mean, I remember very clearly the case of honor killing in Denmark, where actually the family, they had big internal discussions about this issue, should this girl be killed or not. I mean, they didn't agree on it, but they felt such a pressure from the other families living in the community that they ended up doing it. So I don't think it's a matter of really wanting to impose Sharia in England or something. I think it's a matter of I think this very often when dual identities in many ways you fight with having your culture or your traditions from back home with you in the new context that you come in to.
Are there any pressures for change in these countries? And also, whether there's
coordination at an international level, knowing that NGOs have so much impact, even in international affairs at times, you know, make it so that there's pressure on governments to change. I mean, what you're saying about some Arab countries reminds me of a situation which is very similar to what we had in Malta until a couple of decades ago, where, you know, the family law was very, very patriarchal until 1993, so that's very recent. And in a way, there are trends which do not merely belong to Arab countries under the influence of Sharia, but also which reflect a reality of southern European Mediterranean countries like us.
I think it's a very good, I mean, I find that very interesting to hear that you say that, I mean, a lot of some of these things that I mentioned you can actually relate to in relation to Malta. I know also some of the honor killings from, for example, Sicily. I mean, this is not related to necessarily Islam or anything, but simply to, as you say, traditions, cultures. I think what is interesting is, I mean, when you, for example, look at this report or all in all talk about discrimination against women, you can, whenever I did that, I realized that European women would be kind of often very shocked, like, my God, is the situation so bad, and women are so suppressed, and you know, I mean, is there, you know, it's not, we cannot really do anything, it's really a kind of a situation that is unchangeable, while the Middle Eastern women would say, but, you know, the situation now is much better than for our mothers or grandmothers. And that was actually why we did in 2006 this report that we called Change is Possible and Necessary, because we felt that when we talked to both to countries in the European Union and to the EU, we had the feeling that people said, well, but you know, it's really difficult, and what can we do, and there's so much discrimination, and that actually, if you look at this is such a hot issue, it's really, you know, it's very sensitive, anything with women's rights is kind of belongs to the cultural or religious realm, we cannot really touch it, it's kind of a domestic issue for the countries in the region to deal with. And when we looked at what has happened since we tried just to look at some positive changes from 2002 to 2006, it's actually very interesting to see that each issue has been dealt with by NGOs, for example, and even on some governmental level. I mean, violence against women was for many years a taboo, because especially violence against women in domestic affairs, huh? Because rape is kind of, I mean, a husband can never rape his wife because she belongs to him, it's kind of his property, so that wouldn't exist. She even has the right, stated in some of the laws, to beat her lightly if she doesn't obey him. So, I mean, this was simply, you couldn't talk about domestic violence. Now there are dozens of campaigns on domestic violence and how to combat domestic violence. So I think there's and really even on inheritance, which is a very difficult issue, because it's quite clearly stated in the Quran that women inherit half of what men does. Even that issue is on the agenda of the Tunisian women, for example, and they want to change the law because they think it doesn't fit the realities anymore. So I think it's really important and interesting to see that there's hardly any issue that is not contested by some organizations. And there, on the regional level, there are campaigns, for example, on lifting reservations to the CEDAW, to the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which is, I mean, that's a regional campaign. There are, I would say that there could be done much more on a regional level, but it's slowly coming. I mean, I think the Maghreb, for example, is more advanced, and there's been more cooperation between like Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, than there has been in the Mashrek, political reasons and. But now I think there is slowly, there is slowly more and more cooperation going on, especially also between the two regions, and I think there are a lot of lessons learned from Morocco, for example, that can be studied carefully is studied carefully by some of the other organizations. So I think it's really important to stress that a lot of things are going on. It's not like, I mean, these laws might sound very static, no, because it's based on an interpretation of Sharia and its cultural practices or whatever, but actually, I mean, it seems that everything is possible to change if the right conditions, coalitions, and so on are present.
So, I mean, just to try to strike a balance, you know, just to understand your perspective. For example, I myself have lived in the Middle East, and, you know, a lot of times you'll meet women that they say, look, I'm perfectly happy not being able to drive. I'm very glad that my husband, you know, the laws are there to protect me, that if something should happen to me, he's responsible for taking care of me. So I guess, like, I would like to know what your perspective is, because I get the feeling that it's more of a matter of we can change the law so that the opportunity exists. You know, but I just wanted to kind of find out more about, like, what, you know, how do you address or strike that balance? For example, like, you can get to the extreme with, like, honor killings or female genital mutilation or things like that, where to me it's like, well, wait a minute, that's kind of like a universal human right. But then at the same time, you don't want to necessarily alienate the local audience or the local women by saying, you know, well, you know, I'm being kind of hegemonic in my culture because, I mean, do you understand where I'm driving?
I think you make a very, very important point. And I think that's, for me, why I think it's important to, I mean, there are some issues, as you would, that I think are universal, and it's really women's human rights that you can't really negotiate. But, for example, strategies on how to do so, it's not for me to tell how you should implement or do the law. And I think, for example, Morocco is a very good example of that. They realized, for example, well, you couldn't abandon polygamy. They found out, I mean, that it doesn't, even if it says in international conventions that it shouldn't be, it was simply not possible to get people to agree on that. Well, what do you then do? Well, the strategy was to kind of, you know, make it so difficult, but to keep the possibility, let's say. So I think that's very important if you want to succeed. Yeah, that you let the local context has to decide what strategy to use and what issues to focus on. That doesn't mean that you leave everything just, you know, open and everything can be negotiable, but I think you need to leave that because otherwise it would just be imposed, no? I mean, you say it has to be like this, and it might not fit.
I mean, you get into gradations, you know, like where do you, it's such a gray area, you know, where between, like, you say, okay, this is manslaughter or this is, you know, a universal human right, and then, you know, gradually it's like, well, where do you draw the line, or what is the gray area where it becomes, you know, what's the distinction, I guess, between the human right and just the right of one? Like, I couldn't live in some of these countries because, you know, I'm a single woman. You know, I mean, I need to be employed. I mean, I just, you know, I need to drive. Like, I mean, there are all these things that, you know, I just couldn't do. I couldn't buy property. I mean, there are so many constraints, you know, and so kind of like, where do you draw the line to say, you know, what, you know, you know, where does it end? Because it's so gray and nebulous to between the two, you know. There's a big spectrum, I guess.
That's true, but I think also, I mean, it develops over time. I think, for example, again, Morocco is a very good example. I think, in a way, the realities on the ground changed so much that, in a way, it wasn't perhaps so difficult to change some of the laws because things were happening already. I mean, there was a lot of... prices were high, for example. And in order for a family to live, well... the woman had to work. So a lot of families, both spouses had to work. So in a way, to remove the provision that the husband needed to give the permission to the wife was perhaps not such a big issue anymore, because actually society had evolved past the laws. Huh? Then in other issues, you might have to force the laws more, and then, you know, gradually you will accept it. I think it's always this kind of... I mean, you can't just impose a lot of things. You have to strike the balance. And as you say, I think there is a lot of gray zones where... And you will see as well, I mean, in some countries the focus will be more on one thing. In another country, the focus will be on another thing. And I think that reflects the reality simply that... that takes place.
So now with the process of globalization, we know that like the societies tend to go more to the modern part of things. So then they tend to forget about their traditions, and this what is basically happening with the Western societies. But then on the other side, we have those societies who are trying basically to preserve their traditions. Shouldn't we say that this is a very positive thing?
I mean, I think globalization, there's always two sides to it. There is an international thing, and there is, I think, the logical reaction will be also a kind of wanting to go back to something local. I think it's very, in a way, very natural for the human being, because it has to do with identity. You know, you have to feel that you belong somewhere. And I think, I mean, there's not a country in the world where you're not at the moment with globalization discussing what are our specific traditions, what is our specific values. And I think this is healthy. I think this is logical that it will be done. And I think this is being done in the Arab, Middle Eastern world as well. And I think it's nothing, I don't think that it's necessarily scary or anything. I think it becomes scary if you want to impose a specific interpretation of that local context on.
The Arab societies are trying to preserve their traditions. They're not that flexible to changes to the new all the process of globalization. They're not that flexible as the Western societies are. And I think I see it from a side that as a positive thing. I mean, people tend to be one society today, and they forgot about their traditions. Even my country, they tend to forget about different traditions, and all becomes one, you know.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that globalization will lead to everybody being the same. I think simply people have the urge still to have their own identity, and I don't see it as that people are losing in the Arab world necessarily their cultures, or that they are not so. I mean, I think there are a lot of things going on in that region as well. I'm not sure that they are less prone to change.
Well, I just wanted to make reference to the matter of NGOs in general. You made reference to the number of NGOs which are incorporated within your organization. There's a bit of a problem. I mean, you generally sound very upbeat in a way, you know, compared to the Human Development Report in 2002 and so on, where you clearly, as you said, made reference to the fact that one of the factors identified as inverted commas holding back development was in fact the gender matter, but you seem to have got vibes or feedback back from NGOs in the Maghreb and certain parts of the Middle East which seem to make you feel positive about developments. Yet NGOs in these countries are notoriously not NGOs. Is there perhaps a risk that one may be interpreting or seeing too much in the feedback? I mean, is there not the risk, in other words, that some of this feedback is a bit cooked? Because, quite frankly, if you look around you generally, or you don't need to be in this business, but you just read the newspapers a little bit, and some of the indicators clearly are not very positive. And as to the capability of an organization such as yours or any other, even international governments, states, to influence internal developments, the clear example, obviously, is Iran and capital punishment, where despite all the pressures and all the calls at all the levels of the EU, the number of executions doubled over a period of a year, practically. So are you not being, perhaps, are you not looking at the situation through rose-tinted glasses?
Yes, I am naive, because otherwise I wouldn't be in this business. It would simply be far too depressing. So yes, I'm naive in a certain way, because I do believe that changes are possible. But I what I didn't, let's say, come, or I didn't end, I mean, I'm still not at the end of my talk, so I know there remains a lot of challenges. But I think from my work, I just had the feeling that there was this kind of, oh, it's so difficult, changes will not happen. A little less, you say, well, if you look at all the statistics and so on, it's such a bleak picture. And for me, that, it translated into nearly a kind of, oh, we can't do anything. And that is not the feeling I get when I work with organizations in the region. Then concerning your issue on NGOs, yes, there are a lot of gungos in the region, as you can say. That are governmental created NGOs. There are a lot of organizations in the region that are working under kind of a royal patronage. But at the same time, they are also what I would call more true NGOs. And of course, you can discuss how wide or how much power do they have to influence the situation. But I still think that if you look at, for example, again, the example of Morocco, or the fact that there has now been changes to the nationality laws in both Jordan, Egypt, and Algeria, I think you have to admit that sometimes they do succeed. And the fact that they are still there and that they still believe in it make me think that I need to be naive or continue to be naive and support them. I mean, I'm not saying that now, you know, change is coming about like that. It's a long, long struggle, and there's a long struggle ahead, because I think we all need to be aware. I mean, that was probably the first lesson I learned when I naively went into this business, that, I mean, women's rights will always be a hot issue, because it really touches a base of society, you know, because it has to do with the power relations between men and women. And it's often, I mean, really the core of how you organize your society. And I think we need to be simply aware of that, that it's not something you can change overnight, because there will always be people who have the feeling that, well, if women win, I will lose. And I mean, it will obviously change the roles in society. But for me, having stated that, doesn't mean that we should give up the struggle.
Previously, you spoke about the personal status laws, and especially marriage, divorce, children, some things we can relate to here, especially the divorce issue being culturally and religiously held back. But apart from that, yes, no, we don't have it because of cultural and religious reasons. The civil movement hasn't gained ground. I was wondering about education. Is there any, I mean, what is the status of girls and their schooling? Because if they are being excluded from, you know, education and knowledge and sharing in possibilities for their future, well, then their future looks very bleak, and the power relations will take a very long time to shift. So just wondering about education.
I mean, that is a very interesting issue for me, and perhaps actually one of the fields where I even dare to be a little optimistic, because if you look at, both development organization and women's rights organizations, and even from government sides in the region, there's actually been quite a focus on especially girls' education. I mean, there has been huge advances in the enrollment of girls in schools. I mean, if you look over the last 40 years, there's really been an extreme increase in nearly all countries in the region. In most countries, it's compulsory. And the interesting thing is, of course, that you will see, what you will see is, of course, that the higher up you go, the fewer girls you will have in education. But still, there's quite a high percentage of women attending universities in the region now. And for me, I simply don't see that when you have more and more educated women, I mean, in several universities, there are more women graduating each year than men. They will not accept just to be at home, not using their education. So, I mean, actually, exactly that point gives me some hope for the region. I mean, in relation to also what you said, a lot of challenges, because I simply think that something will happen because of that single fact.
If I may go back to the issue of tradition and change and culture, I understand that some people, especially in the context of globalization and some societies, would look back on and make endeavors to keep to their tradition. But there are traditions and traditions. In the last century, we have seen the world changing drastically. We have just been discussing education. Girls weren't sent to schools. Education for girls was very unimportant in our culture, in most westernized cultures. Does that mean that because traditionally girls weren't sent to schools to keep within our tradition, we would continue to do so? Violence, the husband had, and even nowadays some people consider it the husband's right to be violent if the wife raises her voice or in any way annoys him. Does that mean that because traditionally our society accepted those norms, today we should accept them as well? Abuse of children, incest, health, issues of health. Are these issues going to continue because traditionally they were accepted? I think we have to rethink this issue of tradition. We want to keep what is good and valuable in our traditions, but we will question and question drastically other issues which are not acceptable anymore and which we discuss and which we think about and which we move on to redress.
I think you made a very, very important point, and I can just add, I know, for example, from Jordan that there are women's rights organizations arguing exactly that, saying that, you know, we have to keep the good traditions and practices that promote women's rights, but we have to abandon those who are going against gender equality, and trying also, sometimes I think there's a big mix between what is tradition, what is culture, what is religion. It all becomes intermixed, and it's very difficult sometimes then to distinguish what is actually what. And I think often, especially that traditions are then seen as a religious law, for example, which it is not. I think I will actually, because now we have kind of from different angles dealt with a lot of issues, so I think I will not talk very much more about discrimination against women, except mentioning to you, I mean, we've already talked about in penal law that the honor killings, that there are lenient sentences for killing women, because this honor belongs much more to kind of it's an attack on public decency, but it's not a crime against the person. I mentioned before this, that women can't pass on nationality to their children, and that's a big problem, for example, that children will then not have right to education or to health care and so on. In some places, you also had that women need, in relation to traveling, they need the permission of the husbands to get the passport and so on. So there are several issues also in relation to education and employment, and this has, I think, to do with the kind of perception often that the public space is not a place for women. And so if you work, for example, you go out alone, and there are all kind of, again, perhaps more of a cultural ideas about that, then you're not a decent woman. Perhaps one issue that I just want to mention is the discrimination in political representation. Against, it's quite interesting that the Arab world has one of the lowest number of women in political decision making. And there are several reasons for that. Some say that it also has a lot to do with the fact that there is with repressive political systems, the women you have in parliament don't really have any power, or they do not represent women's interest and so on. So why should you have them? And there are, of course, also in some places women have just been put in the parliaments, and they are not necessarily very co-opted and not perhaps very qualified. Still, the interesting thing is that they have now, both in Jordan and Morocco, after a lot of discussions, made a quota system that has actually increased participation of women. There are a lot of discussions against and quota, or pro and against quota systems, but at least I think there's quite a focus now in the Arab world on women in political participation and in political representation. So I think it's an issue that is interesting because it's been such a low number. And violence against women, I think we've already talked about quite a lot. Then, very briefly, I wanted to mention in relation to compliance with international women's rights instrument, it's quite interesting that in all constitutions of the countries, there is it's referred to kind of equality, that all countries in the region have actually signed up to the CEDAW, but they have made so many reservations that actually...
So it
has kind of watered down the convention, and there's now, as I mentioned, this campaign going on to lift the reservations, and both Jordan and Morocco has actually lifted some reservations lately. And I think it's interesting because it shows that, I mean, often it's been said, oh, it's difficult to work on these international conventions because it will exactly go again. People will feel that these are Western concepts and it has nothing, it's not rooted in local culture and so on. But the fact is that it's local organizations working, and often again in alliances with on a regional level, for example, has actually done that some changes have come about. And I still think that it's an important framework to keep. Now I have to wrap up, I'm told. Okay, I want very, very, very briefly to say, for me, generally perhaps the lessons learned is that, as I said, women's rights issue is a contested area. So, and it's very touchy, so I think one has just to know that this is how it is if you work on that issue. And I think the biggest challenge is to show that by promoting women's rights, both men and women will gain. It's not a zero-sum game where because women are empowered, men will lose. It will change the power relations. Secondly, I wanted also a little, as a non-Muslim woman working in the region, I think it's important that we really listen and learn from the concern of the local people in the region. I mean, it's not for me, as I also said, to tell, well, in Denmark we did like this, so you have to do this. I have to listen and hear what the concerns are. And I think also it's important to work in equal partnerships with the actors. I have, in my NGO world, often seen this strong, big European organizations working in so-called partnership with the local organization in the region, which just becomes a kind of implementing agency, and I don't think that that's viable in the long run. It's really, I don't think that will bring changes. Then I think it's important to divide and discuss roles carefully, because I think it can be very useful sometimes, for example, to bring somebody from the region to the EU. It gives much bigger credibility if you can bring somebody actually working on the ground and can really outline the situation, just as well as sometimes it helps to bring, or it helps the local organization if there is somebody from a white face, somebody when they negotiate with their governments. But again, it needs to be clear that it's something that you have negotiated. You don't just show up and think that it's a good idea. And then I think you have to be aware that, I mean, if you work in a regional setting or any kind of Arab EU relations, there is a risk for the local organization that they will be looked at being kind of agents of the West, or that if you often their organizations working perhaps with a Christian background or something, that they will be looked upon as trying to introduce or convert or whatever. And I think again, I mean, listening and learning from the local organizations, working in partnership with local organizations, instead of trying to change the world by yourself, is the most important lesson from me. And then perhaps very briefly in the end, that I think I want to, there's three things that I wanted to perhaps, for me, work for. And this is to fight this notion that women's rights are kind of cultural or religious and something domestic to work on. I think it's really important that we say, well, that women's, I mean, you can find women's rights are human rights and it's universal, then the strategies you use to work for gender equality can be different from country to country, but that women's rights are human rights and universal. And then perhaps also to fight a little the notion that, for example, which I find very much in Europe at least, that the Islamists are more authentic to the societies than women that work more on an international agenda. I see that especially the last few years, it's like, well, but they are the true representatives of, let's say, the countries. And I think that that should be challenged at least. I'm not saying that they do not represent a view, but I think it has to be challenged that they are more authentic.